Okay, so I think we can go ahead and get started. As it's 11:33 Eastern Time in my watch. So thank you everyone for joining and welcome to the Talent for Turnaround Community of Practice, the first session focusing on evidence considerations for SEAs and LEAs. My name is Itay Mizrav. I'm a senior consultant at the Center on Great Teachers and Leaders. And with me today is Lene Dunn, who is a senior researcher at WestEd and the assistant director at the Center on School Turnaround. Lene is an expert on evidence and school improvement and the intersection between the two. I'm very happy to have her with us today as a presenter. As you all know, the Talent for Turnaround initiative is a collaboration between the Center on Teachers and Great Teachers and Leaders, the Northeast Comprehensive Center, the Center on School Turnaround, and the West Comprehensive Center, focusing on school improvement and talent. Ever since the beginning of the, this is a conversation, and if you want to participate, and we encourage you to participate, please use the chat function or unmute yourself and feel free to chime into the conversation. We'll be monitoring the chat, and again, you're welcome to unmute yourself and join the conversation. As I was saying from the very beginning of this initiative, I think we set forth this theory of action, saying that if we want to ensure that students in our lowest performing schools are taught by effective teachers in schools with effective leaders, then we need systems for attracting, supporting, and retaining educators with the knowledge and skills required to turn around low performing schools. So the idea is to find that connection between talent improvement and school improvement and focus on that resource that low-performing schools need more than anything, a great teacher. The Talent for Turnaround Initiative, as you remember, focused on three national meetings, where the first was around needs assessment and root cause analysis, the second was on strategy implementation, and the third earlier this school year on sustainability and scale-up. And another important benchmark for this initiative is the formation of the mentoring and induction affinity group for states and districts focusing on that particular topic. But now we're on to the next step of the Talent for Turnaround initiative, and that's our community of practice, where this would be the first session. And this community of practice we built based on your feedback that you gave us throughout the project and then specifically during the last national meeting. And you surfaced several issues that we would be focusing on in this community of practice. First, this session focusing on evidence-based strategies and the considerations for states and districts. And then later on, we'll mention the sessions that are coming up that are focused on the needs that were surfaced around resources for strategy implementation and support and sustainability and scale up for T4T strategies. We have two sessions lined up on these two topics. But today, as I was saying, we want to focus on considerations around evidence base. And we know that ESSA requires the use of evidence-based strategies in school improvement activities. And we want to try and answer the question of how can states, districts, and schools leverage the requirement to improve schools and close gaps. So instead of having this requirement restrict your pool of available strategy, instead of having it being the way of improving schools based on your own local circumstances, we want to offer a way in which you could leverage this requirement to make sure that your school improvement activities are indeed focused on the students who need it the most and lead to school improvement. At this point, I'd like to turn it to Lene, who will be covering most of the content today. Lene?
Thank you so much, Itay, and good morning, everyone. It's great to be here and talking to you today about evidence and school improvement. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about differences between No Child Left Behind and ESSA, around the evidence requirements. And even last week, I was talking on a panel about some of the intersections between the evidence and the equity lenses within ESSA, that there really is an opportunity within ESSA, even more so than there potentially were with No Child Left Behind, with a focus on equity and evidence. In No Child Left Behind, you know, there was a definition of scientifically based research. It was really a push to look at programs that had strong evidence, and that was primarily defined by a randomized controlled trial. ESSA provides a little bit of a different lens, that thinking about there are levels of evidence, and those levels include a level that is more exploratory, recognizing that there are many fields, and particularly many underrepresented student populations, that don't have evidence of the effectiveness of certain strategies on them. So they're different. It recognizes there are different strengths of evidence, and there's an opportunity to build evidence over time at the local level. I would couple that with the very specific call in ESSA. You know, No Child Left Behind gave us that opportunity to look at subgroups and really made a lasting impact on our field, I think, in looking at subgroups. ESSA takes it even a step further and says we're looking at achievement gaps, and that there is a shared accountability and shared responsibility within states and districts to address those gaps. So ESSA has four evidence levels, from strong, which is level one, down to level four, which is demonstrates a rationale. So strong evidence is defined usually by a randomized control trial, so an experimental study. And moderate evidence is a quasi-experimental study, so making sure that there are some tight controls around a comparison group. Promising evidence is a correlational study, and the demonstrates a rationale is basically that you can lay out a theory of action, that what the strategy is has research and evidence to support the strategy that's coming together. So it's usually like there's been a strong evaluation of that that could potentially move up to a further level of evidence. So these aren't mutually exclusive necessarily. A strategy could have evidence in different buckets. So some research studies might find, might qualify for strong evidence for one strategy, and another might qualify as promising. So you really have to look at the body of evidence for a strategy. I think something that's really important with the ESSA evidence levels is that all four of the levels really focus on improving student outcomes. So you need to, especially at the top three levels, have statistically significant effect on improving student outcomes or the outcome of interest. So the emphasis here is saying we recognize there's different levels of evidence, and that can shift over time. But using these four different levels of evidence gives us a shared definition of where a study falls, where a strategy might have evidence of its effectiveness and its ability when implemented well and when it fits the context to make improvements on student outcomes. So this evidence, the shift to evidence base from the No Child Left Behind era, where there was really a lot less levels of definition, a lot less clarity around those levels. There's some implications in this. Of course, it means there's greater flexibility. ESSA in general provides a lot of more flexibility for states, and it does allow for more choices. So that bottom level of demonstrates a rationale really allows states and districts to build evidence of strategies within their own context. It allows some choice within that. And paired with that means that there can be a better match to needs. If you can build evidence at the local level, or you can use strategies that are at different levels of evidence, you might be able to find something that maybe is promising for its defined evidence level, but it fits the context and the needs that you have more than a strategy that has strong evidence. I think it's important to say that, the assumption of ESSA and I think of most states and districts as they're implementing this is you want to find a strategy that has the strongest evidence possible to meet the needs. So those really go hand in hand. They shouldn't really be a trade-off for each other. Ideally, you want to find a strategy that has the strongest evidence possible that fits your context and your needs. So with this shift, there's also a lot of responsibility that has been shifted to states and districts. And I know, you know, many of you have talked about those shifts and those responsibilities. And, you know, that has the federal government isn't going to provide additional definitions around some of these things as they're implemented in the field. That's the states and districts making some of those decisions. So when that increased responsibility happens, there's really more need for guidance and support. And I hear this from states and districts all over questioning, you know, how do we implement this? What does this look like? How do we make some of these decisions so that they're not necessarily trade-offs between the strength of evidence for a strategy and the fit to our context? So there's really this, I think, need for additional support and additional thinking collectively about what this looks like together. So we have a quick poll, and I think the best way to say this is the first response, just type in a 1, the second response, type in a 2, the third response, type in a 3. So we're interested in knowing if you have a systemic process for identifying evidence-based strategies. So the first is you do not. So if you don't have one, just type a 1 into the chat. If you do have a process, but it's not based on the ESSA evidence levels, type a 2 in the chat. And if you have a process that is based on the ESSA evidence levels, type 3 in the chat. So we're seeing a lot of ones, and we don't yet have a process for identifying evidence-based strategies. Give a few more minutes for folks to weigh in. Okay, so you see a 3 that there is a process based on the ESSA evidence levels. So I think, you know, there is a real mix across the country. Some states and districts are starting to put those processes in place, and others are just in the beginning processes of that and really trying to figure out first the definitions of how you apply these. You know, there's some guidance that the federal government put out about these levels that's been helpful, I think, to states and districts in trying to think about how you have those shared definitions and what that means in an applied sense. But then, you know, putting that into a process is a whole different step, and it can be a big leap and a big jump. Thank you for sharing where your process is. So one of the things that we've been working on is thinking about how do you help use the opportunity of ESSA and the evidence requirements of ESSA in a continuous improvement framework. So there really has been a push within ESSA and the evidence requirements within ESSA for continuous improvement. It's really embedded within there that you're not just selecting strategies and then hoping that they work, but there is a responsibility and an accountability for ensuring that there's some kind of monitoring and assessment of how well those strategies are working once they're being implemented. So this 5-step evidence-based improvement framework came from a guide that WestEd put out in evidence-based improvement, and we'll talk about that resource more at the end. But this 5-step mirrors the 5 steps that are in the federal guidance around ESSA evidence provisions. So the first step is to inform, really finding out what your needs are and shifting your focus to address those needs. So you really have to know what is the problem that we're trying to solve, and really spending the time with good root cause analyses, good assessments to understand what some of the issues are, and then prioritizing what issues will be addressed. The second step is selecting evidence-based interventions or strategies. The word interventions is used in ESSA to mean strategies, programs, all of those different types of strategies that they just are calling interventions. But select is, how do you find the right intervention or strategy, look at what the components of that strategy are, and think about the evidence levels for those to identify strategy that has the strongest evidence available for its effectiveness and a fit with the needs that you identified in the first step of inform. The third step in the process is to plan. I think this is a really important step, and sometimes one that gets glossed over because we select an intervention and then we just want to go out and implement it. But the plan step says, what are the strategies that need to be in place to ensure that there will be effective implementation? So this could be things like making those considerations about the context and thinking, okay, if this strategy requires X amount of training, what do we need to do to ensure we have that in place for teachers to get that training? It can also mean things like thinking about how it will be monitored and how it will be assessed. So spending the time to think about good implementation. We know there's a lot out there around good implementation science of how to develop implementation strategies that will help lead to success. Then the implementation, you know, this is really a lot of the heart of the work. You're implementing the intervention, but what's really important is that you're embedding a cycle of improvement within that so that you're using it as an opportunity to say, how well is it working? Make those small adjustments so that you're trying to get the best outcome that you possibly can, and reflecting on it before you get to the final step, which is analyze. That's more of a summative assessment to say how effective this strategy or intervention is in our setting or our context. So the implement one is more the formative assessment of how well it's working, and then the analyze is more the summative. And then again, that's a cycle, because you're thinking then, once you see how effective something is, then you also have to look again, okay, so then what are our needs within, how have those shifted over time? So this cycle continues to repeat in these five steps. We're going to use these five steps today to kind of talk through thinking about the application of an evidence-based improvement framework within the context of our community of practice here today. So a lot of these questions that we're going to pose to you are ones, obviously we don't have time today for you to reflect on all of these. They are based on our guide, but they're really an opportunity to step back and think about, if you don't have a system in place yet, thinking about what you need to consider to set a system in place. And I think we start with the overall cycle of improvement because we think it's important to see this as an opportunity for that overall cycle, not just an isolated decision to find an evidence-based strategy. It's really thinking about, how do we set up a cycle to ensure continuous improvement using that strategy. So thinking about your overall cycle within your SEA or the LEAs that you're working with, what is that process? If you don't have a process, maybe you're going to use the five steps that are in the federal guidance, or maybe you have a different set of steps that you have, but really identifying and articulating what that process is for evidence-based improvement and decision-making. And then thinking about, where is evidence and research and data integrated into each of those steps? How is data, what systems do you have in place for districts to inform what their needs are? What systems do you have in place to help guide districts in thinking about the selection of evidence-based strategies? So where is research, data, and evidence kind of integrated and integral to each step? Where do you have gaps? So some states we've worked with, as they've worked through this framework, they've realized, gosh, you know, especially that plan step, we haven't had a plan step in our process. We've really cut straight to the implementation. So thinking about, whatever your process is, where might there be some gaps and where might you need to provide some additional support? And then pairing that with, what kinds of supports are you providing to the field? And if you're an LEA, what kind of support are you receiving, and what other support do you need within those steps? And then how can you use that framework to think about your overall process and how you could improve that process. So really think about that cycle of improvement. What are the steps for the process that you have in place? Where do you need to make some changes in that process? So now we are going to ask you to reflect a little bit, and you can use the chat to do this, or you're welcome to unmute yourself and just talk. But, you know, we asked, you know, do you have a systemic process in place for selecting interventions? And most of you said, not yet. And we had a few that did have a process in place. But this is asking, do you have a cycle of improvement in place? So you might have a process for selecting interventions, but do you have an overall cycle of improvement in place? And how do you use evidence or data within each piece of that cycle? And then really specific to this work, how do you or could you apply that overall continuous improvement process in your mentoring and induction work? How have you built in opportunities for embedded improvement within your processes? So we'll take responses both over the phone and by chat. I might pick on my Arizona friends, not just because you all are my Arizona friends and we share a locale, but I noticed, you know, you all put that you have a system in place that's based on ESSA evidence levels for the selection of strategies. Could you talk a little bit about kind of your cycle of improvement and how you have been embedding data and evidence into that cycle and how you are using that in mentoring induction or might use it? If you don't mind me putting you on the spot, Devin and Trish. Okay, I don't know if you all are might still be on mute.
Yeah. If folks need help unmuting, you can go. There should be a, if you just hover over your name, you should be able to unmute yourself. Or you can certainly use the chat function.
Okay. Trish said that Devin got disconnected.
Okay.
Okay. So go ahead, Carol.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I was kind of communicating to my Rhode Island colleague a little bit, because I think while in the work that the Rhode Island Central Falls District team has been doing, they clearly have been engaged in all the steps that you have described, and they spent a fair amount of time looking at research and best practices in designing their comprehensive induction program. So while I don't think they or we explicitly said, yes, we are meeting the ESSA requirements, that is what they have done. So I'll just throw it out to Drew if he has any other comments to make about that, or Kathy.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, this is Kathy. And so, Drew, if you want to chime in, that would be great, too. I would agree with you, Carol, and I think that in the context of the Rhode Island work, the process of identifying, one, a theory of action, of course, which is that base level of the ESSA, you know, evidence-based kind of continuum, that has been from the get-go. And I think as time has gone on, the LEA SEA team has developed criteria for success in terms of standards of performance for the mentors themselves working with new teachers, and currently have identified a series, a protocol, and a series of questions to engage those mentors in a focus group to gather more evidence, to feed back into the system, and kind of really the spirit of a continuous cycle of continuous improvement is there. And actually, the evidence-based cycle is one that we are using, though a technical way of thinking about evidence is something that's still on the front burner for them. And Drew, if you want to say anything more about that. Oh, I see that Drew has said something here. again, kind of reiterating that though we don't have a specific, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying, yeah, continue the thought, Kathy, go ahead.
Yeah, no, just that, you know, there has been from the get-go a cycle of evidence-based improvement.
And I think that's really the place to start, right? Yeah. That you want to have your cycle of evidence-based improvement in place before you're even thinking about, I think, a system for the specific selection of evidence-based strategies, because as you talked about, and as Drew, as you're saying in here, the intent of ESSA is really about that cycle of continuous improvement, and the selection of an evidence-based strategy is one component of that. And I think sometimes we focus a lot just on that select step, but it's the overall process that is a really important frame. So, you know, I'll say, like, this is really, these questions are from the first tool in our guide, because we think it's so important to start there. So I think if you've already started there as a state or a district, that's a huge first step, because if you don't have all the components in place for a cycle of improvement, you can have a really strong selection process, but if it doesn't get supported by the other steps, it's probably not, you know, going to be carried out as well as you would hope it would.
Lene, this is Devin, and I need to apologize to everyone for hanging up. I really just took it off mute, and you went away.
Oh, no problem, Devin.
So I heard part of what was said, and that's exactly where we are. So the whole CNA, the whole Comprehensive Needs Assessment, root cause analysis, and writing the plan, continuous improvement process, then becomes the cycle with monitoring action steps and evaluation action steps that keeps that continuous improvement cycle going. And specific to mentoring and induction, our schools that are focusing on that then have very similar to what Kathy was saying, the surveys and the data that's determined from walkthroughs and those kinds of things that informs the practice on a continual basis.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone else want to share a reflection on this, of kind of where your districts are, where you as a state are? Okay, well, I think we'll go ahead and move on. We've got a lot to cover, so this is helpful to hear where you are. And it sounds like most of us are kind of where the majority of states are, which is looking at this overall cycle and thinking, okay, how do we put this cycle in place? And then the real, I think, elephant in the room is that select step. How do we identify, examine, and select interventions that are going to meet our identified needs? So, For select, there are some real considerations and key questions. One is really, what are the most pressing problems or issues? So, you know, you've thought about that in the informed step. You have your needs assessments in place to identify what those what those problems or issues might be, and then really prioritizing them. So we know we might identify quite a few issues that need to be addressed, and we know this from school turnaround research and lots of research about change and improvement, that we need to focus on a few key priorities, right? We don't want to have too many priorities that we're trying to address. So identifying what those key priorities are, and then articulating upfront what outcomes do you want to achieve? And again, I think this is something sometimes we skip over because we just think, well, of course, we just want to make some things better, but really articulating, here are the issues or problems, here are the outcomes that we'd like to see, helps us get specific when looking for an intervention or strategy to address that and help achieve those outcomes. Because that leads us to what interventions might actually help achieve those. So there's a few steps, and these are just kind of the key steps that we have in one of the tools in the guide, and there are different ways to do this. But, you know, looking at, you've identified an area, you've thought about what outcomes you want to achieve and some possible interventions, but then you're trying to select within that set of interventions. Now, of course, this is assuming that there's research on multiple strategies with whatever issue you're trying to address. And we know, and I think Itai's going to talk more specifically about this in a little bit, there are some areas that have some thin research right now. And so that's, I think, is a field, something that needs to continue to grow, is a stronger research base for different strategies and different strategies used with different populations. But looking at what research is out there for the strategy that you're considering, and then thinking about the level of evidence for each study. So I know when we talk about the evidence levels, I kind of mentioned that sometimes the strategy can have research that puts it in several different buckets. And I think that can get kind of challenging to think about, okay, well, then where do we place this strategy on this evidence, on an evidence level? And that's why it's really important to think about the body of research, the body of evidence, that if there's one research study that has put it as strong and has really, you know, great outcomes, and then there are five studies that maybe were at a lower evidence level but didn't show strong outcomes, you have to weigh that and think about, what does that mean? And think about with what the context of that study, of each study, was. What were some of the considerations within that study? And then think about that cumulative body of evidence. What does it say about the strategy in general? And then what does it say about the strategy and its use in our context? And there are many contexts, especially rural communities, communities that serve Native American students or other underserved populations, that there may not be a body of evidence within that context. So trying to suss some of that out and think about, how does this look and apply within our context, can be a really important piece. So there are different resources to help you identify research. The What Works Clearinghouse has done a lot of changes recently. They're trying to align their outcomes or their assessment of studies based on ESSA evidence levels. So you'll see, if you haven't been there in a while, go check it out, because they've really reorganized some of the way that they're presenting things. So you'll see here, you can look at different topics, and then you can narrow it looking at what population was studied. You can look at the evidence within it. And like I said, they're starting to apply some of the ESSA evidence levels. So it is a good resource, and I especially encourage you, if you haven't been there in a while, to check it out. There's other resources. I think one of the things that can be really challenging at school sites, district sites, and states is we don't always have access to research portals that can be helpful. So ERIC can be a really helpful resource for finding research, but not everyone can access that. But Evidence for ESSA is another one that's open to folks, and it does use ESSA evidence levels. It primarily focuses on literacy and math strategies, but there are some other strategies that they're starting to put up there. Something that's interesting, if you don't have, if you're considering a strategy, especially in literacy or math, that does not have an assessed evidence level in the Evidence for ESSA, you can submit it for review. And I talked to Bob Slavin about it a few months ago. You know, you can submit something for review and they'll review it within several weeks. So that can be something that could be a useful resource for you for literacy or math. The Campbell Corporation also has some really good assessment of evidence levels of different strategies as well. So there are some resources out there to help you identify what that research is. And of course, if this is a program or a curriculum, the publisher often has some assessments of their own research out there. But that leads us to thinking about some considerations of research. You know, there are, and this is not an exhaustive list. we initially had started to try to make a one pager of what these considerations are for research, and it's turned into four pages, and we're not even done because it's so complicated. But there are some big buckets to think about. There's bias, and there's different ways we think about bias. The application of bias here is thinking about kind of who produced the research. Where was it published? Was it a peer-reviewed journal? Or was it like a think tank? or the publisher. You know, those are important considerations when thinking about, is there potential bias within the study? Were the measures developed by the program developers, or was it developed by researcher, like outside kind of established measures from outside sources? What outcome measure, was it scored by individuals who kind of knew the treatment condition? So sometimes if teachers are doing the outcome assessment, it can be complicating if they knew the participation in the treatment or control group. They might be more apt to look for changes in one group over the other. So those are just a sample of the kinds of things you want to think about when you're looking at research studies about the bias. So just wondering who did it, what kind of measures were used, who developed those measures. Really the research quality. So what's the design and the outcomes? One of the first questions to think is, you know, are they using anecdotal evidence? A lot of times that might cut out a lot of studies, not to say that those aren't important, because it is important to understand context. And I think there's a lot of important research out there to help us understand context. But really thinking, if it's just an anecdotal story, we're not going to get to the ESSA evidence levels. So we want to look at statistical significance. Effect size is a consideration to think about. It's really in addition to statistical significance. Something needs to be statistically significant to be an ESSA evidence level. But, you know, effect size can be helpful to practitioners when it's in a real-world metric, like how many days of instruction or an increase in the standardized test scale score. Think about sample size. Think about, you know, what kinds of tests were used in the students. I think something that's really important, and I think Atai will pick up on this later, is were the results positive across all outcomes for all students, right? So were there particular students or subgroups of students that it wasn't as effective for? That's an important thing to think about. And then thinking about just the relevance. Was the intervention delivered to students under conditions that could be conditions that are in the schools and districts that you're trying to use it in? Was it a meaningful outcome for what you're interested in? So there's a district in a state that I've been working with that they were looking at a particular program and strategy. It had a strong evidence base and it met the strong evidence level of ESSA. But when they really dug into the outcomes, they recognized that they had a big need around phonics, and the outcomes that were studied in the body of evidence for this particular strategy did not include phonics. And they were ready to make an investment in this program and then realize, wait, is this outcome really relevant to what we're trying to affect in our context? So asking those kinds of questions can be really important. And then, of course, thinking about, you know, how similar was the population studied to your district or school? Because we think if there's a similar population, you're probably more likely to get similar results. Doesn't mean that if it wasn't the similar population, you can't use that strategy. It's just another set of considerations that you need to think about. I'm just going to pause here and see if there are questions or thoughts or reflections before we move on from this. So I think as you're listening to this, you might be thinking, oh my goodness, she just said a bunch of words that some of them mean a lot to me and some of them don't mean much to me because not everyone is should or needs to be a researcher, and we have to think about within our agencies, both the state and the district level, our different capacities and how will we use some of the questions or some of the considerations to provide feedback to districts and schools about the selection of interventions. I think this is one of the hardest things about implementing the ESSA evidence provisions is really, you know, and I work with a lot of states and districts across the country on this, of how do we really set up our structure within our existing capacity? Like, we have two people, you know, in our school improvement division. We possibly couldn't look through all these different research studies and come up with an assessment of the evidence level. And I think that's really important to consider as a, as an agency of kind of, or a district, kind of where, you know, where your capacity is, what resources you have, what processes you would use, and really, to what extent will the district or the state judge the reviews of research or evidence that other, like, that a school is providing to you or a district is providing to you? What role do you want to play in that? That's, I think, a really important consideration as you're trying to build this within your own systems and structures, and recognizing and leveraging some of the existing systems and structures that you have in place. So we want to put some questions out to you to think about. And again, these, you know, in our guide, we provide you some more support to think through these, but just wanted to give you a few questions to consider. You know, what are really important considerations of context within your settings? How have those considerations helped you think about the selection of strategies? Or, you know, how have you been thinking about identifying the need and desired outcome before choosing an intervention? How might that kind of help you implement evidence-based practices, or how has that? What have you been doing to think through some of those issues or strategies? So I know I know that within T4T, there's been a lot of discussion, especially around rural communities. Is there anyone that wants to talk a little bit about some of the context considerations within rural communities as you think about selecting evidence-based interventions? Like, what have been, how has that influenced the way you've looked at strategies, or what have been some of the challenges around that, especially when we think about recruitment of teachers or mentoring and induction?
Lene, this is Andrew in Arizona.
Hey, Andrew.
Hi, Andrew.
Hi. I don't know if Karen Butterfield is on, but I know that through the T4T process and over the three national conferences, I'm thinking of Chin Lee up in the northeast corner of the state on the Navajo Reservation, and they used the data process early on from the first conference to begin to evaluate what they had even identified as their problem with retention, recruitment and retention. So that's a case of the data that they were studying, showing them that they might actually have to redefine what their challenge was. That produced a completely different set of strategies, which ended up producing really good results in the area of retention. So that's kind of a foundational piece.
Yeah, that's a great example. Yeah.
Andrew, and just to build on that, this is sort of a different example, but in Rhode Island, the community in which the induction program was being designed and implemented is a high need community. And, you know, they were very intentional to really think about how do you design and implement an induction program in an environment where trauma is front and center. You know, what do educators really need to know and be able to do to support students in these environments that are very complex and related to sort of what these kids are facing on a day-to-day basis. So they were very intentional about that. And so, you know, they chose to do induction and mentoring because of the research base, but then they were very intentional about, okay, so what's out there that tells us what we need to do in this kind of environment? And so I just wanted to share that as an example.
Yeah, that context piece and really thinking about how that informs the selection and prioritize your needs, right? I mean, your context helps inform what needs you want to address first.
I agree with that, Lene. This is Kathy, and so maybe it would be great to hear, because I think everyone's struggling with having an evidence-based plan, a selection plan in place, that to maybe to hear more about different contexts and how we might think about identifying evidence-based strategies based on that context might be useful, just as an idea.
This is Dorothea from Indiana. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Hi, thank you.
We have really worked hard to implement the PLC model from Dufour. And that whole model really lends itself to having evidence-based strategies. And some of the evidence is not only the evidence that is beyond, that is research-based, but also the research that's the action research that's done by the teachers. And that's been very powerful. So once strategies are identified to meet the need of whatever is identified, then the teachers go off and implement that strategy for the next week or two and come back and actually bring the data to show the results of that.
That's such a great example of embedding within the implementation phase that formative, assessment of how is it working in our context. Like, we know we might choose a strategy and it seems like it's going to be an effective strategy and there's a strong research and evidence base for it, but knowing, is it working in our context and having teachers engage in the action research to demonstrate that? That's a great example of using context considerations and assessing that within the overall context. I just wanted to give pause before we move on just quickly, to elevate what Kathy, you were focusing on that question that said, like, what are our context considerations? So what are, within your own context, what are some of those key considerations for your context? I mean, we know rural, applying the selection within a rural context or applying the strategy within a rural context can be really important and a key consideration. But what are some other context considerations that are important in your context?
Hi, this is Carol again, and this is not really in direct response to your question, but what this has made me think about and recall is that when you're working with folks to look at the research, you try to answer two questions. What is this telling us, and what is it not telling us, right, regarding the particular needs in your context? And so I think when you have a lot that it's not telling you, then it's incumbent upon the group to set out a plan to collect their own evidence, right? So it could be based on a solid evidence base, but if it isn't complete and there's not a high level of confidence that it is everything that a particular context needs, then I think they have to kind of collect their own evidence.
Yeah, and I think, what's great about ESSA level 4 demonstrates the rationale is that there's that opportunity for building local evidence and using that to share, across the state, with other districts, with other states, so that we're learning from each other's implementation. That's great. Okay, well, let's move on to the next step we're going to talk about in the cycle, which is the plan. And this is the one I was saying that often we don't think about as much as we probably should because we're it's hard to make some of these considerations, but we have a few key questions and steps. And this is these are pulled from tool 6 in our guide. But one is, how well is this strategy going to fit in our context or setting? So Atai, I think it's the next slide. Are there particular things about our context or setting that are important to think about fit? And we have some questions that help you unpack that a little bit. I think one is the cost. you know, sometimes if there's a lot of materials that need to be bought, or there's a lot of training that teachers need, just really thinking about that, especially I think in rural communities, sometimes access to professional learning providers is more limited or can be more costly. So thinking about those costs, you know, specific to the context or setting that you're trying to apply it in is important. And then the feasibility of implementation. So, you know, do we have the staffing structures? Do we have the time in our school day to use this particular strategy? You know, I think there are a lot of kind of key questions that you can consider. I will just quickly make a note that the regional educational laboratories, there's 10 across the country, Crossrail Group, we're working on some strategies, questions to ask about the implementation, as you're planning for implementation, some key considerations and really unpacking this and providing some support around that. So as a group of RELs across the country, we will be putting something out to help states and districts think even more specifically about some of these considerations. But I think the overall thinking in the plan step is not only what will it take for making the strategy or intervention happen in our context, but what's unique about our context that might affect implementation, which I think really helps us move into thinking about evidence through an equity lens. So Atai, I'm going to hand it back to you.
Thank you, Lene. And yes, and I think that context would be what we want to dig a bit deeper, and specifically the context of low-performing schools. T4T is about school improvement. So as practitioners, we should consider the special considerations, the special circumstances of those low-performing schools. So what I like to do is wear two hats now, both my hat as a consultant that works with state, but I also want to think about my own experience recently as a practitioner. Up until recently, I worked at a state on school improvement, implementing school improvement strategies. And I want to think with you about some of the limitations for the evidence-based approach and how it plays out in low-performing schools. And specifically, dig a bit deeper into three limitations that I guess that and predict that many of you feel on a day-to-day basis. First is the fact that the evidence-based ladder, going all the way from demonstrating a rationale to strong evidence, is focused on strengths but not on content. The fact that it's not equity-specific, and the fact that disadvantaged groups may be underrepresented. So the first limitation is the fact that we're focused on strength rather than content. The evidence levels represent the number or the quality of the studies that are conducted on a specific strategy, but not the content of that particular strategy. And for improvement to work, our work has to rely on strategies that are focused on the specific root causes for low performance. And those needs to be identified by a robust needs assessment at the school level. So even if a strategy is on the strong evidence level, it's unlikely to be effective if it's not focused on the specific area pointed by the needs assessment that we want to engage. Therefore, states and districts and schools should not be tempted to start the improvement process by maybe looking at a pool of strategies that meet the strong evidence criteria and choose one of those strategies. Rather, we want to start by determining the need and then identifying the strategies with the best available evidence, of course, but those that are tied to that need. And those may be strategies at lower levels of the ladder. And in fact, I would say that we would prefer a strategy at a lower level that is tied to an identified need that is relevant to our context, than a strategy at a higher place in the ladder that is not. In fact, let's remember that new and innovative strategies are unlikely to have a strong evidence base already established. And existing practices are what led us to the place that we're in, the achievement gaps that we're in. So new ideas are important to get us out of this unbearable reality of achievement gaps. So if choosing a strategy without strong evidence behind it, it's important to plan how evidence will be gathered to observe impact. So if you are going with something that is on the lower levels of the ladder, you can think, as Lene was explaining, how would you use evidence to show whether it's effective or not? And the example from Indiana is fantastic to that effect. The second limitation that I'd like to speak to is the fact that the evidence ladder or the evidence-based approach is not specific around equity, and we should be. It's not specific on regarding whether we want impact on disadvantaged students, which we do. So we want practitioners to consider not only the level or strength of the evidence, but also whether they specifically point to impact on disadvantaged students and on students and educators from minority backgrounds. You know, there is research that suggests that measurements such as, for example, good teaching may mask or overlook or even ignore unique practices that are necessary to raise the achievement of historically disadvantaged populations. Think about how average gains and studies that show average gains may hide very different results for disadvantaged students. These disadvantaged students, when they're in minority, they may not impact the determination of the evidence. Think about that for a second. A study that just looks at averages and didn't specifically look at students from minority groups, whether it's working or not, that strategy, that may be decided by the majority of students, by the white majority of students for that matter. So we want studies that specifically look at the impact on disadvantaged students. For example, programs that show average improvement of student achievement, they may not be impactful for closing the achievement gap. I remember from my own experience in school improvement, what was shown to be effective may not have worked as well in those particularly low-performing schools that have unique circumstances. Programs that are shown to improve teacher practice may have negative impact on, for example, on diversifying the workforce. I'll give example for that in a second. So we do want to prioritize evidence that report outcomes that are specific to disadvantaged students and students from minority background. And we should further prioritize studies that include specific equity outcomes, such as narrowing the achievement gap or impact on recruitment and retention and effectiveness of teachers of color. And then finally, I touched on that. The very last limitation that I wanted to discuss is the fact that disadvantaged groups are often underrepresented in research. When was the last time that you've seen a research checking whether teacher leadership is effective for Native American students, for example? Researchers often choose explanatory power and large sample sizes, and therefore these groups that can produce those large sample sizes that would give that statistical significance that is asked for when we're designing these strategies, they are underrepresented in this research. One of the ways to address that is to include qualitative research. And again, I'm going back to that example from Indiana of using feedback from the teachers as agents of change to demonstrate whether there is impact, particularly in low-performing settings. So these are three problems that we're as practitioners that are doing school improvement work need to address. Now, I want to share a bit of what I've learned to be the particular context of low-performing school and maybe the reason why we're seeing different results. Because those schools are very different from some of the other schools that we know. Low-performing schools are characterized by fewer resources, limited attention and capacity for implementing new programs, which is a problem if we think about communications, for example, of new state programs. Many accountability and school improvement related programs, requirements, I'll add pressures that are on those schools that they many times these low performing schools feel like they serve the programs rather than the programs serve them. And so there's not much capacity for an additional one that we're trying to implement. They have higher rates of novice teachers. They have lower rates of experienced and effective teachers. So when we're looking for evidence of impact, we got to find the studies that accounted for that so that we'll be assured that those studies will, that those strategies will be impactful in these particular settings, the settings of low performing schools. And so the process I would recommend would be, as I said, not starting from the pool of strategies that are that have high evidence and then finding one that match your needs, but the opposite. Analyze the local needs, particularly think about those circumstances that I've just listed. Think about those issues. Analyze the local needs. Identify the root causes of the gaps. Only then identify the strategies that are specific to the root causes, prioritize and take those with the best evidence, but also with the relevant evidence base, with the evidence base that reflects specifically on those particular students that have the highest need. And I want to give you an example of a study that doesn't do that and then a study that does do that. So you'll be able to kind of with me think about the kind of studies that we're looking for and the kind of evidence that we're looking for. So the first one, and I shared a little bit of this in the last national meeting, there was a study on the DCPS Impact Program. The DCPS Impact Program was a new teacher evaluation system that was introduced. And one of its components is that it was a high-stakes system and that teachers who received an ineffective rating were dismissed. And in this study, the researchers, Tom D. and Jim Wyckoff, tried to understand whether the implementation of the new high-stakes evaluation system improved instruction in Washington, D.C. And as you can see from the chart, for example, the dashed green line is the 2010-2011 year before the implementation of the program, and then after is the 2011-12 is the blue line. They were able to show that instruction in Washington, D.C. did in fact improve, which is impressive and it's good news. But I remember when I read that study, I was thinking about a few open questions that I'm left with looking at this chart. And the main one is whether this improvement was true for all schools and particularly for those schools that are behind. What we're looking at is average or overall result, but we don't know whether schools that serve predominantly minority students or low performing schools have seen these gains. One suspicion that I remember having is that a dismissed teacher in a wealthy school or an affluent school is replaced by one of maybe 10 candidates that are lined up to be its replacement. Whereas in a hard-to-staff school, perhaps we dismissed an admittedly an ineffective but a 10-year veteran African-American teacher and replaced him or her by a younger white teacher in a predominantly non-white school that may have not retained for long. Well, this is just an hypothesis, but it's an open question that I'm left with looking at this study. So to ensure equity, we want to think about the measures and outcomes separately for different group of students so that we'll know that this actually worked for them. Particularly, I want to call out racial minorities and English learners and students with disabilities. And I'll add to that students in low performing schools. Sadly, many times that Venn diagram has very large overlap. And then make sure that average improvements that could be driven by students at the top do not mask a very different impact, a very different result on the achievement gap for different students. So to do that, I want to ask the researchers and I want to ask us consumers to look for measures, to look for studies that emphasize equity outcomes. For example, utilizations of programs in high-need schools, gains in educator workforce diversity, closing of achievement gaps as opposed to average improvements, closing of educator equity gaps. outcomes that are measured by interviews with teachers and leaders in high-need schools. Here's an example of a study that does do that. So I marked down pieces from the abstract from this study, Workplace Support and Diversity in the Market for Public School Teachers, that was published in 2017. And look at how this is different. So this study from the abstract, looking at differential impact on minority students, and it found that support is most strongly associated with the retention for minority teachers working in schools where minorities are underrepresented. So they specifically looked at that context. The effect is pronounced for teachers new to the profession and those in rural areas. Students in rural schools is another underrepresented group in research and in evidence. So this indicates that workforce support is essential in maintaining and growing minority representation in relatively less diverse organizations. This is the kind of measurement that I'm looking for. And look at this chart from the study. It's very different from the chart I've shown you earlier, because this one shows me two lines. One line that reports the results for white teachers, but another line that reports the results for minority teachers, allowing me to focus on those with the greatest need and know that this particular strategy is effective for them as well. So I'd like to stop here and throw these problems and questions and challenges back to you and ask, what are your equity considerations when you think about your low performing schools and those that you're hoping would be the main beneficiaries of T4T and other work? What characterizes these schools? What are those components that you want to make sure exist in the evidence that you're looking for? I'd love to hear your reflections. Again, feel free to chime in the chat or unmute yourself and just talk through the phone. So let's perhaps try to think of the lowest performing school you're working with or the most challenging school. What is the main concern when you were looking at research on whether that would apply to that particular school? What makes that school different? Give you another minute to think about it.
Hi, this is Kathy. I've been just sitting here thinking. First of all, thank you for framing this issue in the way you have. It's incredibly helpful. And actually, in a different project in a different state, not represented here, but around this topic of a larger frame of talent development, including selection and hiring, and then also retention and development. The issue of the focus in this particular context is increasing racial, ethnic, and linguistic diversity of the educator workforce. And so the equity considerations in that context are really large from a systems perspective. And it has to do with things like who is on the selection committee, what processes are used to select and hire people, and then find once you get people in the door, and let's say that leads to an increase of diversity in the way I framed it, then it becomes, what does equity look like from the context of the retention side and the disproportionate attrition that we typically see for educators of color? And so the conversations that we've had in that particular setting have had to do with cultural competence throughout the system. So that it's one thing to hire people and offer them a position, and then as soon as they are hired, it's like induction starts there with, in terms of who those teachers of color are connected with, how the larger community is involved in supporting those same teachers. So those are some of the considerations, at least in that context, that we've been thinking about.
Yeah, that's great, Kathy. Thank you. And the main consideration with regard to our conversation is, where is the evidence that you'll be able to go to that will tell you how retention may play out differently in low-performing schools versus other schools? I'll give you an example. We have data that we're working with that shows that reasons for attrition may be hierarchical, that, for example, teachers may leave a school because they have bad leadership. But only if they have good leadership, then they would think about issues like pay. But perhaps for a population of teachers that is not coming from a privileged background, the issue of pay is more significant than the overall data shows us. And that's why it's so critical to be able to have studies and use studies that observed these populations specifically. Now, Dana Chambers here is asking, how can we do that? How can we reconcile the requirement to use evidence base with the seek to identify evidence for low performance students, which could be sparse? There's not a lot out there. And so I think that the way to do it is, first of all, think about our prioritization. Prioritize, even if it's in lower level of the ladder, prioritize context and prioritize the strategies that do have programs, do have studies that point to particular impact on disadvantaged students. And if those do not exist, establish a coherent plan for how you will measure your impact and how you will produce the evidence and what is the rationale behind your choice. And I think by doing that and showing innovative approach, I'm sure that kind of approach to improvement would be welcomed by the Department of Education. And then I see Lene added a consideration. Who is and isn't at the table informing these decisions? Absolutely. That's a critical key. And we want the planning stage that Lene spoke to a lot to be diverse, right? We want the right people at the table making these decisions. Any other reflections or additions to the circumstances, to what characterize our low-performing schools that anyone wants to add before I move on?
This is Carol, and I think Kathy was probably referring to the same work that I'm thinking of. And I think in some cases, it's really deep. The critical issues are deep, and they have existed for probably quite some time. And so before a school that has a history of underperformance, I think, can effectively take on an initiative, they have to do a very good job of really understanding what is at the root cause of their identified needs. And in some cases, it might be issues of bias that are at play. And if those issues of bias are there, then it takes, specific action to help people address issues of bias and how those play out in, say, for example, hiring or selection or retention. So I think sometimes it's very difficult adaptive work, and it's not just finding a strategy and figuring out, what do we need to do to implement it, but it's really digging really deeply to create the working conditions and the environmental conditions that will enable them to have success.
Absolutely. So, on that note, let me offer, I want to quickly touch on implementation and based on Carol's last note and think about how that specific approach that I'm offering, the thinking specifically about disadvantaged students, how can that play out in implementation? What are the key considerations that you all can think about? And when we think about equity and implementation, we want to monitor the unintended consequences. So did the practice that we've engaged in, did it actually improve outcomes for students who needed the most, and who are the main beneficiaries of it? Oftentimes, we see that strategies that were intended to close gaps are not eventually utilized by our high-need schools, and they do not benefit from them. You can see a district or a state that says, "Oh, we have significant gaps in retention or in novice teacher effectiveness. Let's create a mentoring and induction program," and then they work on the program and they develop it, and it's research-based and it's evidence-based, and then it's ready to go, and then they offer it in the state website or on an email or on some other communications. Who will take it? Who will decide to look for the next great thing that the state is offering and implement it? Of course, it's going to be the schools with capacity, with subs, with time, with attention to these kinds of emails that do not have those accountability pressures. So as we think about implementation, we got to make sure that we are strategic around who are the beneficiaries of the work. So I would recommend thinking about it as a three-step process and stopping at each one of those steps and reflecting on whether we're actually having those disadvantaged students in our mindset. The first would be identifying the need, as I started, the needs assessment, robust needs assessment, root cause analysis, what is the need, and be specific to those students in those schools. Then identify the equity-focused evidence-based, select practices by the content and fit, and only then by the strength. And then finally, monitor the impact on high-need schools and ensure that the beneficiaries are the highest-need schools and the highest-need students. So before the implementation, identifying the need and the right strategies, and then during implementation, monitoring to see that they are indeed the beneficiaries of it. Any other questions or thoughts before we move on?
I just noticed Andrew posted something in the chat.
Yeah, thanks, Carol. I was just thinking again about some of the extreme rural situations where research tells us about the value of teachers of similar cultural or ethnic background to students, and yet the reality is that there's an inequity of access to or development of those teachers. And mm-hmm. you were asking about the considerations and the context where we have research saying one thing and the reality is just diametrically opposed.
Right. So I think that's a great example. And I think, you know, we're dependent on research. And the reason we have these requirements is that we need to make sure we're basing our work on real evidence so that we know that it's impactful. But I think that to that extent, I think it's a very good guidance and requirement. But I think it's our job as practitioners to surface these challenges, because our goal is school improvement and closing of achievement gaps. Surface it to researchers, surface it to other practitioners, to levels above it, whether it's the Department of Education or others, and make sure that we are critical consumers of research that are focused specifically on our needs. And I think your example is a great one. And let me read another comment here. Andrew hits the nail on the head when he talks about trying to find candidates that help me out with equity needs. In a small rural district in Globe, Arizona, we are often forced to hire anyone we can find. It's a great challenge. Right. So your circumstances over there in terms of who you can hire are very different. And we would want to find evidence for programs that can be impactful and specifically look at places that are similar to yours. I know we're a bit pressed on time. So, Lene, let me send it back to you to bring it all to a close.
Sure. Thank you so much. So, you know, we've talked through a lot of the pieces of the continuous improvement process, and we have just a couple of last considerations on implement and analyze. And I think we've embedded this throughout. And I think Indiana talked a bit about how they're doing some of this, of thinking about how well that particular strategy is working, involving teachers and action research to think about that. But really asking some questions of, is this working? What's contributing to it working or not? And what data do we need to assess that? I think that's a really important piece that we continue to embed throughout. So to close, we have a couple of resources for you before we open it up to some additional questions. One is evidence-based improvement. We have a guide that we at WestEd put out for states and districts. There's 6 tools in the guide. 3 focus more at the state level, 3 focus more at the district level. And many of the questions in the presentation today are questions drawn from that guide that kind of helps you consider how to build a structure and support for, especially around selecting evidence-based interventions. And then the next resource is one that is coming out from Talent for Turnaround. It's a review of existing evidence for mentoring and induction. So it's a snapshot that looks at the evidence base for mentoring and induction and provides some really great resources. And I think there's going to be another snapshot coming up, but this one is so relevant to the discussion that we've been having today. We wanted to give that. Your regional educational laboratories are a great resource for you if you haven't used them. They work with states and districts and the evidence-based selection and informing that can be a great resource to you.
Great. And before we move on to talk about quickly about the upcoming sessions, let's take a break for a second and see if we have any last questions, either for Lene or for me, on any of the content that was covered today. I see a comment from Tammy Kazi here on the chat. The urgency to locate candidates of color must focus our attention on what we can do within existing systems to ensure that students of color have access to opportunities that open the door to their achievement and interest and in access to joining the profession. Often we thwart such opportunities for students of color before they are fully immersed in the case as well of context. That's a great comment, Tammy. Thank you for making it. Let's remember that the issue of opening up the profession to additional populations is, yeah, it's a social justice issue for sure. We want our profession to be diverse, but it's also about good policy and effective implementation of school improvement. We won't be able to improve the outcomes of students of color if the workforce is 100% or close to 100% white. So this is a professional education policy issue. And if we are true to the cause of closing gaps, that's going to be something we're going to have to deal with. So that ties back to what kind of evidence are we looking for? Evidence to diversify the workforce or programs that impact it in a positive way rather than a negative way are the ones we want to be focused on if we are to close achievement gaps between different groups. Thank you, Tammy. Any other thoughts, comments, or questions? Okay, so let me turn it for a second to Kathy Dunn from the Northeast Comprehensive Center. Kathy, if you could tell us a little bit about the upcoming sessions, that'd be great.
Sure thing. So first of all, I want to thank both you, Ty, and Lene for a great job today in framing this whole issue about evidence-based practices, and in particular, looking through the lens of equity. So I'm thanking you for all of us. And as we, the planning team, looks forward to the next 2 communities of practice, we have 2 scheduled, the second on Monday, May 13th from 12 to 1 Eastern. And the focus of that will be on implementation. The third will be on Monday, July 22nd, same time, 12 to 1:30 ET, focused on sustainability and scale up. Now, what will be a little bit different in both of these community of practice sessions is that you participants will really be the ones kind of presenting. And we're going to be using a consultancy model where you will all be invited to identify your front burner challenge, whatever it might be. Call it a problem of practice. And based on what your challenges or problems are, you will be matched with teams and you'll participate in a consultancy using the breakout rooms available in the Zoom platform. Now, just a moment about this. So as we shift to implementation and sustainability and scale, but let's take implementation as our first, clearly this is a systems issue by definition, right? To implement something well and so that students are the ultimate beneficiaries, it takes a lot, right? We have to think about all aspects of the system and how it focuses together. So getting the grain size right for the problem is something that we just want to spend a minute about. So here's an example. We've hired six of our teachers to serve as mentors and coaches. They're released from their classroom, and their primary responsibility is to mentor and coach these new teachers. Based on a recent survey, what we find is they're only spending 40% of the time of their available time working with new teachers, where the goal is really for them to spend 80% of the time mentoring and coaching them, with 20% of their time designing and facilitating professional learning sessions. And in probing further, what we found is that principals were pulling these teachers to do other administrative tasks. So by example, a request for feedback might be something like, what we would need to do to get back on track, and we would love to learn about strategies you, consulting partner team, have tried or would suggest for us to tackle this problem. So we just wanted to share that as an example, and also note that while the example is specific to mentoring and induction, your problem or practice or challenge might not be that, we realize. So as you think about this, we think it's an exciting time as all teams are really into implementation, and this will provide an opportunity for you to learn with and from one another. So at that point, I'll pause to see if anyone has any clarifying questions. Well, terrific. Itai, I'll turn it back to you to close.
Thank you so much, Kathy. I look forward to the sessions. Last item for today, we would love your feedback on the session and on the COP. Here is the link. We would also send it out. Please use it. Please click it. Give us some feedback so that we can learn and improve for the next sessions. And share some of your ideas on the content that you would like to see going forward. So again, here is the link, and we please ask you to fill it out. And then lastly, here are the content information, contact information for Lene and myself. We're both free and available. And please feel free to reach out if you have questions that you didn't have the opportunity to ask today, or want any additional information on the content that we've presented. So with that, I'm going to go back to the survey link as I close. With that, thank you all very much for joining today, and we look forward to seeing you on the next session. Thank you.